For the week of January 22nd, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 352, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz, Gong Hei Fat Choi, Sperling.
Gesundheit?
Happy New Year.
I know.
On this Saturday, January 28th, it will be the Year of the Rooster. People will be celebrating it all over the world. It's specifically the Year of the Fire Rooster. And celebrations go on into February. I was born in the Year of the Horse. I don't know what year you were born in, but it's a fun couple weeks. If you're anywhere in the country where there's an Asian population, there'll be fireworks. There will be fun and noise.
Well, you know, actually, I don't know when. Actually, I was born, okay, based on what I just looked up here. Thank you, Google. I was born January 29th, a certain year. I'll let you figure it out. Year of the Pig by 2 days. I missed being Year of the Dog by 2 days.
Well, pigs are smarter.
Well, you know, they do eat garbage, right? I mean...
Yeah, well, I've seen your diet. So, you know, yeah, it's the year of the year of the rooster, year of the pig, year of the horse. It's fun. And it's also, of course, a big significant date for box office worldwide because that's when people go to movies. It's a really big holiday for movies. You're going to see like 5 or 6 films open up in China this week. And Hollywood movies will get shunted to the side.
Yes, that's right. There's kind of I don't want to say a ban, but a blackout is the right word in China for Hollywood films during this time period.
Certainly for that week or two. But that's one thing we'll learn about this week. What else will we talk about this week on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at the...
Academy Awards.
Yes, the Academy Awards. The weekend box office.
Oscar.
And yes, and why China is about to explode with new local movies.
Oscar.
Well, I don't know about that being the reason, but well, and yes, we'll go over the... Very unsurprising Academy Award nominations. Talk about unsurprising. I mean, we could have reported this story last week. Speaking of China, the Wanda Group is expanding its worldwide theatrical exhibition reach yet again. We'll tell you about their latest acquisition. During our book filter segment, Michael will power through not one, not two, but 5 new releases just begging to be turned into a movie, documentary, or TV show. These better be good, Michael. 5? I mean, you know, 1 is pushing it, but 5? On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the music industry, where album sales matter less than ever, but music publishing is still a gold mine. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have links to ComScore. That's the base of where we draw our information from. But we also look at Variety and Hollywood Reporter, box office profits, box office mojo, the numbers, you name it. And the number one film around the world is XXX, The Return of Xander Cage. No, it's not a porn film. It's an action film starring Vin Diesel. $70 million worldwide, so a good solid relaunch since they spent about that much money making the movie.
Although here in North America, there was a bit of a, I don't want to say shock, but certainly a surprise. I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, M. Night Shyamalan is back. In North America, XXX a little bit underperformed, and Split, the horror film starring James McAvoy, overperformed. $45 million over the weekend, most of that coming from North America. It was a low-budget, independent horror film that Shyamalan funded it out of his own pocket, basically. This is his second hit film in a row. He's back as a commercial force, no doubt about it. He's made movies for $5 million. That was the one right before this. That was The Visit, and that made $100 million worldwide. And now this movie cost $10 million, and it's already made $45 million on opening weekend. So this is really, you know, he's back. He's in control. He's making low-budget movies, and he's making a lot of money.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a... I wonder, he's written both of these movies. There was that time there where he was... kind of just making movies nobody cared about.
That's true.
They were so creatively kind of bankrupt, if you will.
But they were also his movies. It's not, I mean, he did make the Airbender film, but he did make movies that were his, like The Village and so on. And they felt like they were just trick ending. And people got bored by the pattern of that. These may have trick endings. I don't know. I haven't seen either of them, but they feel a little down and dirty and different.
Now, he made Unbreakable. Did you like that film?
I liked it pretty good, yeah. That was certainly back when he was still, you know, people still got excited by his movies.
He was coming off of Sixth Sense then. He made Signs.
Right.
Did you like that film?
The terrible ending, but it was, I thought it was, most of his movies are technically very proficient, really interesting sound wise and all that. But Signs, I think, was where it really started to go wrong. You know, it was just a very, very dumb ending.
I did like The Village. I did kind of.
Well, you're alone. And then The Happening was dreadful. And, he just went off a cliff. Yeah, no, he's been in the wilderness. And instead of trying to make bigger and bigger movies like his pattern, he's just, out of necessity or choice, he said, all right, I'll just, make something cheap and make it on my own. I'll do exactly what I want out of my own pocket. And by God, it's working.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know that he had some run-ins with Disney for a while. He kind of, I don't know whether it was on Last Airbender or whatever. I mean, we've gone on too long about Mr. How do you pronounce it? It's Shyamalan. So we've gone on too long. We should probably.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, we should probably, believe it or not, went to film school with him. Still can't pronounce his name. But,
well, at number three around the world is another success story. It's La La Land, of course, which just got a ton of Oscar nominations. $25 million over the weekend, $175 million worldwide. And boy, is that an amazing accomplishment for a musical. That doesn't happen every day.
No.
And number four is another musical, Sing, the animated film, $17 million over the weekend, $430 million worldwide.
Now, you know what? Five. I know we're talking, you just mentioned Sing as an animated film, and I know this is completely unrelated and somewhat of a tangent, but I finally saw a screening of Zootopia. This is the film.
Oh, you hadn't seen it yet.
I had not seen it. I missed it, before it came out. I missed it while it was out. And I thought, you know what? I really want to see this on the big screen. So I waited for a screening. And boy, you could kind of fault the story. It was kind of, thin at best. But talk about political commentary delivered with a spoonful of sugar. It was, I thought that was the best part of it.
I didn't think there was any thin story. I thought it was a terrific noir. I thought it was one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, it was really good. I was really surprised.
None. I didn't think the storyline was weak. I thought it was fun and clever and really well done. And yeah, there was a lot more pointed, commentary from the film than I expected.
Yes. And timely.
Prejudice is always timely.
Okay, I'll remind you of that.
Yeah, it will never not be an issue. At number five, another hit, Hidden Figures, $17 million over the weekend, $85 million worldwide, though that's almost all coming from North America, another big Oscar nomination winner.
I'm tempted to make a joke here that Pharrell Williams produced this movie, and after it was nominated for Best Picture, I wonder whether he was happy.
Oh, God. Well, at least we didn't call it Hidden Fences. And number
true.
Six is Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, $16 million, and it has now officially passed the $1 billion mark, which is half of the last Star Wars movie. Nonetheless, for a one-off film, that is a terrific accomplishment. And number seven is an example of why you do hire movie stars. It's Passengers, which has felt like a flop, but it made $15 million over the weekend. It's at $270 million worldwide. It stars Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt, and it will just about triple its budget. They're not going to make a ton of money on this movie, but they're not going to lose money either. And number eight is Moana, the Disney film, $15 million over the weekend. It passed the $500 million mark. It still has quite a ways to go, I think. There are some big key territories to come for this one.
Did you and see number in Zootopia there was kind of a side joke that I think it was the weasel that was pirating DVDs and pirating movies. And he said at one point, he's standing on a street corner in Zootopia and he says, hey, I've got, the latest and greatest movies. I've even got some that haven't come out yet. And one of them was Meowna.
Yeah. They're bold. They're sassy.
Yeah.
That's right. At number nine is The King. This is a Korean political thriller. It's set in the 90s and about trying to seize power by somebody who's working through the law and finding out the repercussions of when you're in the 1% or in charge. It made $10 million on its opening weekend. And number 10 is Arrival, which was almost a complete triumph at the Oscar nominations, except for Amy Adams. $10 million over the weekend, $170 million worldwide. At number 11, a movie that wasn't even mentioned at the Academy Award nominations, Assassin's Creed, $10 million over the weekend, $200 million worldwide. Another flop, Monster Trucks, another $10 million. It's at $40 million worldwide, but obviously it's got a number of territories to go. Maybe it'll click in some overseas markets, but this is going to be a long, slow slog for that movie. And number 13, Harvey Weinstein does it again with Lion, $7 million over the weekend, $27 million worldwide. It's not a commercial hit, but thanks to a lot of key Oscar nominations, it probably will become one. At number 14, why him?
I don't know. I have no idea. You meant the movie.
James Franco, $6 million over the weekend. It passed the $100 million mark. At number 15, another Korean movie, Confidential Assignment. This is kind of interesting. It's about a North Korean investigator and a South Korean detective working together to track down a bad guy. So that's a really interesting movie, given the split in those two nations. I wonder what the politics of it are like, how it plays to people. It had a decent opening weekend of $6.4 million. Looking down, trying to find some new news, the founder, Michael Keaton, opened up very poorly, and he did not get an Oscar nomination. Live by Night, certainly, you know, at one point imagined it would get a lot of Oscar love, and it didn't, and it's doing poorly in 40 territories. It's made $15 million worldwide so far.
Now, let me ask you this. Like, when you say Live by Night at one point had some Oscar content, was that like when the screenwriter went, you know what, I could probably win a lot of Oscars if I wrote a film about, I mean, seriously?
That's when Ben Affleck, whose last three movies were all critical and commercial successes and received a lot of Oscar love, and his last film won Best Picture, adapts a best-selling novel by a critically acclaimed author named Dennis Lehane, the first in a trilogy with a Godfather-like scope. Yes, they had every reason to believe that they were making a project that would benefit from Oscar love.
Well, okay, when you put it that way, it actually makes sense.
Moving down, the Met did another live broadcast. Romeo and Juliet made $2.8 million worldwide, though I saw a weird figure that they said it can cost $3 to $4 million for a Broadway show to do one of these things, and I thought that sounded high. But
that really does sound high. I mean, maybe, I mean, granted, from what I've heard, it's about $1 million to do one of these Met operas, but...
But they have, maybe they have the infrastructure in place already.
Exactly. Doing one of these, if it costs that much, you're doing something wrong, because you will not make your money back. Most of these productions do not make $2.8 million. So if you're spending $3 million, you've already lost money.
Right. They were talking about, I believe it was Allegiance, the George Takei musical about imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Another timely issue, unfortunately. And they talked about it in theaters, and they were going to do a rebroadcast, and they had the figure of $3 to $4 million to do all that. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. That can't be right. But I don't have any particular figures to back that up from them. But that's interesting. If you know something about turning a Broadway show, or specifically the Met, into a broadcast that you're going to do live over, movie theater screens, contact us, right, Sperling?
Yeah, you can do so by emailing dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And we do read your emails and play your voicemails at the end of each show. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Our page should come up, and people do leave notes there. I know Raul Buril left a number of stories there that we are covering this week.
That's right. And maybe you're in the Czech Republic, because that country had a great year at the box office. The box office set a record. I assume this is for a record for the modern Czech Republic, which was established in 1993. They grossed $80 million at the box office. And just as importantly, they had a record number of admissions of 15.6 million people. Local movies snagged 30% of the total, which is a great number. And Angel of the Lord 2, which is sort of a Christmas holiday sequel to a film that's become a perennial, was the number one film at the box office. So it was a good year at the box office for the Czech Republic. And if you're in a territory and you know what your territory did, like in Sweden or Japan or whatever, and you want to let us know, you know, use one of those ways to reach out to us.
Well, yeah. And there are, this is the time of year where all of the local government agencies are saying, you know, here's how much the box office made, here's how much local films made. So it's a good time of year for that.
That's right. And we know that China box office is about to heat up next, you know, with the Chinese New Year coming on Saturday and then on for the next few weeks. Arrival did open up there just under the wire, and it opened weekly. So it didn't do great at the China box office. For some reason, it didn't click with them. So they won't have any real reason to complain when they get kicked to the curb for a bunch of big Chinese movies that are about to open up. But China is, of course, expanding, and that's the Wanda Group. What's going on with them, Sperling? Theatrical exhibition is your world. What have they done?
Well, it's really not the Wanda Group directly.
It is.
It is AMC Cinemas.
It's Wanda Group.
Right.
They own it. Why bother saying AMC, which is owned by Wanda? It's Wanda. They bought it.
Well, I mean,
they're just trying to hide behind the Don't you think that this is just an attempt to sort of soften the blow and make it not sound as, you know, they don't want to stir up xenophobia?
Well, I think that's partly true. Yes, I think that is partly true. There's also financial reasons for it. And that is that right now Wanda's stock isn't doing all that great. So you can't really, you know, when you're looking for cash to make these big deals, you need to take stock into consideration and, you know, where you're going to get the money for it all.
But it's a subsidiary of Wanda Group.
Yes, and I do think that at some point AMC and all of these companies will be rolled up into one giant Wanda. If I think that's the ultimate goal, although I don't have any, you know, inside information on that. I think that's just kind of the long game.
But what has happened this week, whether you want to call it their subsidiary's name or the owner's name, Wanda Group, what did they do this week?
Wanda owned AMC Cinemas, bought Nordic Cinema. Okay, and they bought it for $929 million. Now, that's a lot of money, okay? And it's a lot of money for 68 cinema buildings comprising 463 screens. That is $2 million a screen. To give you some perspective on that, and we have recent perspective because last year AMC did $2 billion deals. So they bought Carmike, okay, and they bought that for $1.2 billion, and Odeon and UCI in Europe for $1.2 billion. The difference there is that Carmike had 271 cinemas and 2,917 screens, and Odeon had 244 cinemas or 2,251 screens. So,
all right, you're throwing a lot of numbers at us.
So basically,
they paid a premium for fewer screens in the Nordic and Baltic regions.
$2 million per screen as opposed to at most $533,000 per screen.
So why were these screens in the Nordic and Baltic region worth this premium, or did they overpay?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, and my colleague at Celluloid Junkie, Patrick Von Sikowski, has a great post on this over there that is worth reading, because he talks about the fact that AMC had already purchased Odeon and UCI, largest exhibitor in Europe. Okay, so they are already the dominant player. Cinema City, or I can't remember who purchased Mars. I think it was CGV, actually, purchased Mars in Turkey. So that was a big player in Europe or in Central Europe that could have been purchased. So there are very few opportunities to expand without the EU coming down on you for antitrust. If you're AMC, you can't buy a big circuit in Germany without the EU saying, wait a second, you already own the largest, you know, European.
Right. They're number one in Europe. They're number one in North America. And now they are number one in the Nordic and Baltic region. And it's a territory where they don't have any regulatory oversight as such. It's more easy for it to go through, and therefore they've done it.
Right. Well, they do. However, what their argument is, and it's a legitimate argument, is, hey, you know what? We don't operate in the Nordic area, so it's not antitrust if we're just buying something in a market where we have no interest presently, as opposed to buying something in Germany where you do have an interest.
How much of the entire worldwide theatrical exhibition market do they have right now?
They are the player. I think they have 10%, 11%?
I think it's 12%, not counting this new acquisition that we have. And
yes.
Their goal, as they've stated, is to get 20% of worldwide movie exhibition market share. Latin America and Japan, watch out, I guess, right? That's where they got to go next.
Yes, you're right. It's 12% is owned by Wanda. So you've got AMC, Hoyts in Australia, Carmike here in the US, Odeon and UCI in Europe, and now Nordic Cinema in Northern Europe and the Scandinavian countries.
All right. So, I mean, obviously next they got to go to Latin America and Japan, right?
Yes. And they probably will be. Certainly Cinemark is pretty big in Latin America. Cinepolis out of Mexico is in India, Mexico, and Latin America. So I'm trying to think, you know, they would have to start scooping up smaller players. It's a much more fragmented market in South America.
Do they want to be players in India, or is that such a local market with local movies that it's harder for them to be a player there?
That's a good question. I do not know. That's a very good question. It's a tough play there, and I don't know that China would want to get involved in that, but, you know, who knows? I know they look, I'd say yes, actually, because they want to be big everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Make sure you put a link to your friend's story in our show notes, because I don't see it there yet.
No. Oh, okay. I will make sure to do that.
All right, well, the Oscar race is really starting to heat up. I can't wait anymore to start talking about this. All right, gaining momentum is the romance The Big Sick, which just got bought for $12 million by Amazon. Then you've got Armie Hammer's gay romance Call Me By Your Name, which got rave reviews. I have friends who saw it. Our friend Stephen Garrett said it was really great. That's from the director of I Am Love.
Is he at Sundance this year?
Yes. Okay. We've got Mudbound. This is going to be a big Oscar player. It's the period drama, which is the first chance for the Academy Awards to avoid being tagged Oscar so white yet again, thanks to Mary J. Blige in a supporting role. And Dee Reese, the director of Pariah, who's in the director's seat. She's very talented. I've interviewed her. Then there's Lois Smith. She's definitely in the running for Best Actress with Marjorie Prime. It's very exciting, the Oscar race, I think. It's just really starting to congeal. You can see who's going to be a player, who's going to be involved, and what's going on here. It's very exciting.
Well, yes, and you would be talking about the Oscar race for 2018, not 2017. We should kind of point that out, maybe, don't you think?
Oh, that's right, yes, of course, because you never stop talking about the Oscars.
That's true. So we're already, you know what? We know what's happened in 2017, and we'll get to that in a second, but we're already jumping ahead. Let's leapfrog over to 2018. What do you think?
I think we just did, and now it's time to go back.
Well, before we do, you know, you just said that Oscar's so white, you know, you know, they may have, the Academy may have kind of averted an Oscar so white with this film, with the Mary J. Blige performance, right? That's the...
Well, I'm just talking about there's more movies coming forward in 2018 that look like they will be quality films that will have good talent that they'll want to support and get behind, and happily that will take care of it. I mean, this year they had a lot of acting nominations, the most ever for people of color. These movies were all in the works before last year's Oscar nomination. So this is not a reaction in the terms of what movies got made. And if the movies aren't made, you can't nominate them. So the big problem is always getting movies made and getting people who have diverse color behind the scenes, and women, and, you know, people of different sexual orientations. All that has to happen. And then the movies have to get made before you can even consider nominating them. So, you know, this year is not a reaction in terms of what movies got made. So you can say, well, maybe they were scared. And I think, no, there were good movies and they were happy to support them. I think next year, if there are no good movies getting made, that's the problem. That's where the source of the problem begins, not as much the Oscar nominations themselves.
Good point. What I was trying to, where I was headed with my comments was that last year out of Sundance, you had The Birth of a Nation, which Nate Parker, everybody was thought, you know, this time...
they were ready to hand him the Best Picture Oscar right then.
Right, and everybody thought that would happen out of Sundance last year. So you never know what can happen over the course of 12 months.
Right, a lot of other good movies like Hidden Figures and Moonlight and four out of the five best documentaries were helmed by people of color. So it was a good year in terms of diversity.
Yeah,
and
well,
it's also a good... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, why don't we get into this year's Academy Award nominations, not the awards.
All right. The biggest news is how many films were nominated, and it was 9. And okay, it makes me feel yet again, just make it 10, you know, 8 or 9 or 9 or 8 or 7 or 9 or 8 or 7 or 10 or 9 or 8 or 5. You know, it's like you're never going to have 5. You know, it doesn't look like you're always going up with 7 or 8 or 9. So just make it 10. I mean, 10 best films of the year. To me, that's such an obvious, clear metric that so many critics have used for so long. There used to be 10 Best Picture nominations. Others say, well, make it 5, you know, just go back to what it was for decades. I don't have any problem with that, but this was supposed to solve a problem and it has not happened. And that is to have big fat hits in among the Best Picture nominees. And I'll tell you what, you look at the 9 films that are here, they're all hits. So they're not big hits, but by gosh, Arrival is a hit. Fences is a hit. It's a, you know, it costs $25 million to make. It's going to hit $75 million worldwide. It's not quite there yet. Hacksaw Ridge is a hit. Hell or High Water, that's a hit. Hidden Figures, that's a hit from the U.S. alone. La La Land is a monster hit in terms of its $30 million budget. Lion is soon going to be a hit. It's more than doubled its budget. And thanks to these Oscar nominations, I think it'll triple it. Manchester by the Sea is a hit. And Moonlight is a hit. These are not big budget $200 million movies that became hits, but they are hits, every single one of them. So it's not like they're, you know, having to focus on obscure movies that aren't clicking with the audiences. These have all clicked one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe the only film that you might want to see in here just for what you're talking about and referencing, Michael, is maybe Deadpool.
Absolutely. I think that can and should have been nominated for best screenplay and best picture and best actor. I wasn't a fan of it, but I could totally see that. I also think Zootopia should have been nominated for best picture. That was a terrific movie. And I would have loved to have seen the documentary OJ Made in America nominated for best picture. I think documentaries should be in the mix up there as well. You could have had a foreign film, an international film, I should say. But, you know, you're looking at the blockbusters, to be fair. Other than Deadpool and Zootopia, I don't think there's anything you could even suggest deserve to be nominated for Best Picture. So you know what? Just like you talk about movies with diversity in them, in front of and behind the camera, and you say, hey, you want them to nominate them, you got to make them first. If you want Oscar to nominate movies for Best Picture and you want the big Hollywood movies to be there, you got to make good movies. And there are literally nothing that you would look at and say, oh, they overlooked this film. And no, this is not a year with The Dark Knight in it or something where you say they really ignored a big blockbuster that got great reviews. It ain't there. Deadpool, Zootopia, that's really about it.
Yeah, now you mentioned a couple things there. Well, let's talk about OJ Made in America, because you said, well, maybe that could have been nominated for Best Picture. There was some question about whether it should be considered a film at all since it was made for television. It's a seven.
There's no question. There's no question. If you follow the rules and get a theatrical exhibition and do it for a certain length of time in certain theaters, you qualify.
That is correct. And they did that specifically for that. It was released first in theaters. It was at the Sundance Film Festival last year, as was a film, Life Animated, by Roger Ross Williams and Julie Goldman. That was nominated. I Am Not Your Negro was nominated. Fire at Sea and 13th by Ava DuVernay, who directed Selma. Those were all in the best documentary feature. Not nominated, sadly, is Gleason, which is a worthy documentary.
Well, it's a good list. Is there anything you would have taken off? I haven't seen all of them.
Oh.
Because you can't say this person should be nominated unless you tell which one you would remove.
Yeah, I guess I hate to say it, but I don't know.
So one of them you didn't like?
I haven't seen I Am Not Your Negro, so I can't say.
Well, then
can't
you can't say it shouldn't be off. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
So the four you've seen are all good.
Yes,
correct. They're worthy choices. Certainly, O.J. Made in America is a terrific film. It's one of the best of the year. It deserves its Emmy love. It will get Oscar love. I don't know who will win, actually, Best Documentary. It's going to be a tight one.
Yes,
but
I
do know that up for Best Picture is Amazon. They got a Best Picture nomination for Manchester by the Sea. It's the first time that a streaming service has gotten a Best Picture nomination. They've done well with Netflix, especially in the documentary category, but Best Picture, that's a real stepping stone. There's no hesitation from Oscar voters to recognize this as a movie. It played in theaters, it employed people, it made money, everybody's happy.
Well, and quite honestly, I think Netflix should take a page out of Amazon's book on this one, because what Amazon said is, look, we have a streaming service, okay, and we want content for it. Some of that content will be television shows and will be in the format of a television show, and we will broadcast it and release it as such. So it will be all at once. There'll be several episodes, and you will be able to stream it onto your television. Other content fits more of a motion picture feature format, and we will distribute that content the way such content has been distributed previously.
It's taken a long time to say this. They're showing movies, and they're letting other distributors show the movies in theaters before they show them on Amazon.
Yeah, they're basically saying, let's treat it as a film.
And Netflix says, we don't care about that. We're happy to have that for documentary, but we're all about Netflix, and we're just not that concerned about it. So people who want that theatrical run are not as likely to go with Netflix. If they want to change that and they want to get more films that can be have theatrical legs, they're going to have to start doing it. Or otherwise, they're just saying, hey, we're happy. Your film is going to reach a worldwide audience. You know, they just picked up a couple movies at Sundance. Either they are your second choice or your third choice, or you say, you know what? I've got this small film. I want it to reach a worldwide audience, and Netflix is going to do that for me. And I don't care about the fact that it's not going to get a theatrical run to speak of.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I was at Expo Cine in November, there was some question about what the value of a theatrical release was. This was coming from filmmakers who had just finished, you know, a couple of movies. A couple of filmmakers were saying, I don't care whether my film gets played in a movie theater for, at the time, it was about $13 to $15 to see a movie in Brazil. I care whether people see my movie, and the way that's going to happen is through Netflix. Okay, but those were up-and-coming filmmakers who needed people to see their movie, and more than likely, they weren't going to get a big marketing campaign for their independent films, and so few people would go see them in the theater. What Netflix is saying is they've got a problem, and they cannot cede the authority, if you will, to the theatrical platform. They have to say, no, Netflix is the best platform, bar none, always. Subscribe to Netflix. Whereas Amazon can say, look, do both. Who cares? You know, go see it in the movie theater, and then when it's on Amazon, come and see it over here.
Well, and for the young filmmakers, of course, they recognize that you will be seen more by people on a streaming service if they actually recognize the name of the movie, which happens a lot by getting theatrical exhibition and reviewed in newspapers and websites all over the world. I mean, it's just easier to get attention. You know, a new movie pops up on Netflix that just doesn't create the same heat as a new movie that has already had exposure to the media.
Yeah, you know, over the weekend, I was flipping through Netflix, and I can't remember the film that I saw. I can't even remember the name of it. Okay, that should tell you something. But it was a film, and I was like, what is this? I don't even know what it is. And Chester Tam directed it and wrote it. Take the 10 was the name of it. It is a film that was released, I guess, the same day I saw it on Friday. It's a film that is a Netflix movie, and I wound up watching it, and it was okay, not great. It probably didn't deserve a theatrical release, but I happened to just, you know, maybe I'd had one too much wine. I don't know. I wound up watching it, but it wasn't very good, and I wouldn't recommend it. And it's on Netflix, and if they hadn't shoved it in my face on the main page there, I probably never would have gone and looked for this movie.
Well, look, I mean, they're playing a different game. We'll talk about them later, how well Netflix is doing. Let's not, you know, there's different, you know, you have different values, different concerns. If you have a small film, you're probably going to play at the IFC Center or Angelica or Sundance, whatever, the Sunshine Cinemas, for like a couple weeks. And then you're going to be available on demand or, you know, this isn't like a strange, you know, it's not like playing for 2 weeks at Angelica gives you worldwide exposure like an Oscar campaign.
No, so but a film like Tallulah is a great example of a film that was at Sundance a couple years ago. It's a good movie, and it just didn't get, it was picked up by Netflix and nobody saw it.
Well, I don't know. We don't know their metrics of how much exposure it got on Netflix. But again, if that's the filmmaker's choice. You want to be on a worldwide platform where they're going to push it in front of your face like they did with the movie you saw? Or do you want to hope for a theatrical run? You know, if they offer you more money up front and you know you're going to make your money back, everyone's going to make it and you're going to have a chance at being seen, you know, it's a decision you make. They've picked up more movies. So clearly there are filmmakers. Most movies at Sundance don't get picked up. So if you get an offer and you get a possibility, you know, it's a thing to consider. Certainly Lionsgate is someone you want to have look at your movie. They had the most nominations this year. La La Land and Hell or High Water were their two biggest ones. Nate Parker should take comfort, right? You can always come out of the wilderness, look at Mel Gibson.
That is true. I mean, now mind you, he had a huge career before he kind of went off the rails about 10 years
right.
ago. So it's one thing to have a huge career, do something wrong, and then come back. It's another thing to be at the start of your career and already be off the rails.
As a director, he's obviously had success as an actor.
Yes, correct.
But my favorite part of the year is always when they say, oh, this actor was snubbed. That person was snubbed. My favorite ridiculous example of a snub is people saying Finding Dory was snubbed by not getting a Best Animated Film nomination. Disney has two movies nominated for Best Animated Film, Zootopia and Moana. And people say, oh, they were snubbed when Finding Dory wasn't the third one. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, and frankly, it was not the better of those. I mean, if that was nominated over Moana, I would have to disagree.
Of course, yeah. Well, they'd say it was snubbed if Moana didn't get nominated.
Right.
Yeah, so that's just absurd. It shows a complete lack of whatever. And the animation nominations were great, always interesting. That's an area where you look to see, look at some movies that I haven't heard about and want to check out. Screenplays are often a good source of that, though this year pretty much lined up with the Best Picture nominations. But really, you looked at the list and there were, you know, of course, there were some possibilities that didn't happen, like Sully and Tom Hanks or Amy Adams for Arrival. But really, a list that we are so good at reading the tea leaves, there were very few surprises.
Yeah, especially this year, because Look, I mean, La La Land is such a huge front runner. Did you see Saturday Night Live this week where Aziz Ansari hosted it? But there was a whole sketch about Aziz Ansari being brought in by the police because he said he didn't like La La Land. And they, you know, were playing good cop, bad cop, or actually bad cop, since they were both saying, how could you not like that movie? And, you know, it went on for like 4 or 5 minutes. And then they brought in somebody else who didn't like Westworld. That was the other guy's big crime.
All right. No, I didn't watch it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, what did you think of the Best Actor nominations?
They were expected. I mean, there literally was no surprise anywhere on the list. I mean, you just looked at that and everything was sort of about what we expected.
Amy Adams not being there?
There are easily people I would have. I didn't love that movie, so it's not like I feel bad for Amy Adams. I liked Annette Bening in 20th Century Women. I would have liked to have seen her in the mix. I felt like Ruth Negga and Meryl Streep, frankly, are the Ruth Negga was a surprise, and Meryl Streep is just ridiculous. You know, I don't think it's a very good movie. I don't think it's a performance that's worth singling out. It's as knee-jerk as it gets. I mean, I suppose we should be grateful that John Williams wasn't nominated for his score for the BFG. You know, that's like, you know, those one of those things where they just always do it every year. Meryl Streep, great actress. She should not be nominated for Florence Foster Jenkins. I'm sorry.
Do you think that maybe her speech at the Golden Globes, because that was exactly during that time period is when the nominations were being handed in, okay? So do you think her speech actually helped?
Absolutely not. She's been nominated 20 times. She gets nominated every year. It's only a shock when she's not nominated.
So for Best Actress, it comes down to what? Isabelle Huppert and Emma Stone, right? I mean, that's where we're at.
I think Natalie Portman, maybe. She's always the one that I've thought of for Jackie. I feel like La La Land could win everything except Best Actor and Actress, though I certainly wouldn't be shocked by any woman winning. Casey Affleck is the front runner for Best Actor. I don't think there is a front runner. It's very rare to win for a foreign film. Isabelle Huppert is probably lucky to get nominated. And I think the stunt and playing a real person, I think, helps Natalie Portman a lot. That's always sort of the one out of those five that jumps out at me. But obviously would not be a shock if Isabelle or Emma Stone won as well.
Okay. And
let's not go through everything and our predictions. It's just...
Let me ask you this then. Maybe a better way to put it.
I mean,
it is,
Viola Davis is going to win Best Supporting Actress. I imagine Mahershala Ali will win for Moonlight. La La Land will win Picture and Director and 18 other awards.
Well, that's only nominated for 14, so that would be an achievement.
Yes, but they're going to take awards away from other films and just give it to La La Land.
Best Animation. You know what? Heck,
La La Land. Yes, exactly.
Is there somebody that you would, or a film or a nomination where you're really rooting for?
I did think Mahershala Ali was just sensational in Moonlight. So I'm very excited that he's probably going to win. I'm not an actor I'm really familiar with. Other people know him from television stuff. I think I haven't seen all the documentary nominations, so I don't want to single them out as you know, worthy or not worthy. Same thing with Best Foreign Film. I've got a lot of watching to do. You know, think that's the thing. I got a lot of watching to do. I think, weirdly enough, I don't really like the movie, but I think it would be bizarre if The Jungle Book didn't win Best Visual Effects. And I think for no other reason, it's because that was the first movie in history to launch its Oscar campaign before the movie had even ended. It screened for the first time and they have that card saying, by the way, just shot in downtown Los Angeles in a warehouse. boom, you know, the movie's not even over and they're already doing their Oscar campaign. And I thought that was a brilliant point to say, hey, by the way, this was all crazily special effects. And I think valid chest thumping. And I think it is an amazing technical achievement. And I really think it would be absurd if anybody else won other than The Jungle Book.
Well, when they said jungle, they meant concrete jungle.
Exactly.
Well, I guess I'll just put in one plea, I suppose, for before we leave the Oscar nominations, and it would be for Best Foreign Language Film. Tony Erdmann was probably one of the better movies I saw last year, the German film.
I liked it too. I haven't seen the rest though.
Yeah, there's The Salesman. Yeah, there's a lot.
The Oscar Farhadi is supposed to be very good.
Yeah,
that's the Iranian film about people putting on a production of Death of a Salesman. A Man Called Ova is a nice light film based on a series of, not a series of books, but a book by an author who's had a series of bestsellers, which sounds right up Oscar's alley. But yeah, Tony Erdmann is certainly a prickly, fascinating movie that deserves to be nominated.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael. What books deserve to be, I don't know, read or translated and adapted into movies? Because it is time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And Michael, every week you pick, out of the hundreds of thousands of books that are published each year, you pick a few that we should be paying attention to. What are they this week?
That's right. I work the slush pile now for the Hollywood. I'm saying, hey, here's something that we should option. And, you know, if you want to read my newsletter, you can go to bookfilter.com and click on newsletter and sign up for that weekly newsletter. But this week, there's like five books that I think are just ripe for being made into a film or a TV series or a documentary. So I'm going to try for my elevator pitch, right?
Okay. So you're going to go down each one as if I was a development executive going, what else you got?
Yeah, exactly. I've got Days Without End by Sebastian Barry. He's an acclaimed novelist, and this I would pitch as Brokeback Mountain during the Civil War.
Okay, got it.
To which he'd say, yeah, what else do you got? Gay men and slavery. I'm not down with that.
As opposed to Cold Mountain, which took place during the Civil War.
Exactly.
Okay.
As does part of this book. I've got a comic book called The Abominable Mr. Seabrook. It's by Joe Ullman, and it's a graphic novel biography of this journalist who I've never heard of. And at one point, he was one of the highest paid writers in America, friends with everyone, including Aldo Huxley and Gertrude Stein. He's a travel writer, and he was more drunk than Hunter S. Thompson. I mean, he makes Hunter S. Thompson look like a teetotaler. Half of this comic book is him throwing up. And I think it would be a depressing movie if you told most of his life, but I would focus on his journey to Haiti, where he was determined to watch a voodoo ceremony. And he wrote about it pretty respectfully, especially given the times. And he popularized the term zombie, which no one had ever heard of, all while drinking everything in sight. So he's a hell of a character, a really crazy, nutty guy. You can see Paul Giamatti playing him. Oh, and he likes to tie up women in chains.
Now, what was the book that you had? It was a book of... It was a graphic novelist or a cartoon. It was a
Crazy Cat, the George Harriman.
Crazy Cat. Because you know what?
That wasn't a graphic novel. That was a textbook. That was a biography in text form about a comic strip artist.
Well, the only reason I bring it up here is because many of the books you mention on this, and I'm not just trying to toot our own horn here, okay? But many of the books you mention, I've noticed I'm reading about weeks later in The New Yorker, New York Magazine, The New York Times, Washington Post. I mean, like all of these, The Guardian. I'm reading about all of these books later after you mention them here.
Well, there you go. I'm sure Scott Rudin has already read them all and optioned half of them.
Probably true.
There's True South. This is a behind-the-scenes story about the making of Eyes on the Prize, one of the greatest TV documentaries of all time. If you haven't seen that, you should. Think O.J. Made in America times 10 as far as the sweep and power of this work. And this book is by somebody who worked on that project and tells the behind-the-scenes story of how difficult it was to make. That's probably a little trickier. Maybe it's a TV documentary about the making of a TV documentary. That's where I see it. But you need great female roles, right?
True. Although, if you haven't seen Eyes on the Prize, you probably did not go to public school in the United States.
Did they show that in public schools?
Oh my gosh, yes. Every year.
Oh, well, good for them, because that's well worth seeing. It's a great, great, great series. I went to Catholic school, and apparently we didn't mention it. I did see, but if you need a great female role, there's Dorothy Day by Kate Hennessy. This is a memoir about the radical Catholic activist. She's been an inspiration to millions. It's written by her granddaughter. She was a real firebrand from the 1910s, 20s, all the way up through the Cold War, and she died in 1980. She's a fascinating figure, and you can make a great story about her life. But women looking for a great role, they have to go to Rise, which is a memoir by Kara Brookins. And it's subtitled How a House Built a Family. Now, this woman escaped an abusive marriage, took her four kids and ran. She had no money, nowhere to turn, and nowhere to live. And somehow, she got the crazy idea that if she and her four kids could build a home, they could rebuild their lives. She was not a construction worker. She had barely hammered a nail in her life, but she got a loan from the bank, this tiny little loan. She watched a lot of YouTube videos, and she and her kids started pouring concrete, framing walls, and laid bricks for a two-story, five-bedroom house. And this is the story of what they did. To me, I'm like, has Emma Stone already optioned it, or will she option it?
Can I just thank you? Because last week, we're driving around from meeting to meeting, I was tuning in on the radio, and of course, every time, well, I was listening to the radio, and this story came on about a woman, but I came in the middle. I didn't know who this woman was. I didn't know, you know, what they were talking about, but it sounded fascinating because she was talking about how she had built this house from the ground up, how she got this small business loan or small loan, and she had to finish the project in a certain amount of time, otherwise the loan would go bad, how she had to work two jobs while doing, I mean, it was just, the story was incredible. And then, you know, the person who was asking questions was like, how did you do that? You watched a YouTube video? Like, it just, it was unbelievable. And then I had to get out, you know, I arrived at my meeting. I had to get out of the car. I never found out the woman's name. I couldn't remember the show that I was listening to. So I could never find, I did go back and I was like, NPR, like, what was I listening to where this woman was there and building a house? But I don't know, Google woman building a house. And let me tell you, you do not get Rise by Kara Brookins, you know, shouting out at you. So thank you for bringing this up.
Well, you're welcome. And you don't have to wait for the week of the books to come out. If you're at Bookfilter, you can always go forward into the future week by week if you want to get a head jump on everybody else and know what the big books are coming out weeks or even months in advance. We have that power.
Okay. Well, look, I appreciate it because, and I'm not just, again, I'm not just trying to toot our own horn, but I'm actually learning stuff. I should have actually read the show notes and then I would have actually known that you were bringing this story up, but I appreciate you doing so because now you've answered the mystery.
So I guess for you, it was a big deal that we covered that book.
Yes, indeed it was, but I see what you're doing. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, let me ask, why is Jerry Seinfeld leaving Crackle? He launched his Emmy-nominated online series, Comedians in Cars, at the Sony-owned site and enjoyed carte blanche, naturally enough. But with his deal expiring and Seinfeld's closest ally, Steve Moskow, shown the door at Sony last year, the comedian was definitely in play. And Netflix is the unsurprising winner. They've got a global reach, and they seem determined to pay top dollar to be known as the home of stand-up comedy specials, thanks to Chris Rock, Amy Schumer, Dave Chappelle, Aziz Ansari, and now Seinfeld, all in the fold. The deal includes new episodes, the entire back catalog of Comedians in Cars, new stand-up shows, and a development deal. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, right? Streaming service acquires show. You know, there's a story about why they want to do comedy. And I've been wondering this, like how well comedy specials replay. It seems like you spend a lot of money for just like an hour and a half of comedy.
Yeah, but when,
but I guess it works.
Well, think about it this way. They're just taking a page out of HBO's book, right? HBO has been doing this for
way
decades.
Back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, they see that it works and they can really see that it works because HBO was getting Nielsen ratings and it was kind of a survey and they were told, hey, you're doing pretty good with this stuff and people are you know, subscribing to see some of your comedy specials. Well, in this case, Netflix can know exactly how well their shows are doing down to the second when people turn them off.
Well, there's no reason networks shouldn't be able to know that as well. But also they just say they are the home of comedy, right? That's they want to Bigfoot Comedy Central and Once Upon a Time HBO and just say, if you want to see comedy specials, they can corner that market. It's sort of like the corn market, right? You can corner it. You can corner any market. I guess it's really valuable because then everybody comes to you.
Yeah, we're cornering the podcast market even as we speak, in fact.
Absolutely.
Now, Broadway usually calms down at the box office right after the holidays. And this year, it's definitely the calm before the storm. This season, there will be 19 new musicals and revivals opening, the most new musical productions since Reagan was president. I don't know if that's prescient or not. With no runaway frontrunner for the Tony a la Hamilton last year, everyone has dreams of snagging the top prize. Dear Evan Hansen and The Great Comet are both hits with audiences and critics, but a lot more shows are in the pipeline, from the hit UK show Groundhog Day to the heart-tugger underdog Come From Away. Is this deluge a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's going to be a big deal because there's going to be some crash and burning. There's only so much room for new hits. In movies, we say, hey, you know, hits beget hits. And that's true a little bit on Broadway. You want every show to work because when they're successful, people have a good time at the Broadway and they come back. But they don't come back next week. You know, they come back most people in maybe 6 months or a year. So there's only so many new shows that can become big hits, or at least that's what it's been true in the past. And we already have two movies that are in the $1 million club, basically, Evan Hansen and Great Comet.
Two movies. So I'm not, two movies. I'm not, you mean two, mm-hmm. two shows, two productions, not two movies.
Right. Oh, I said 2 movies?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's just not that much more room, but there's a lot of big names coming out. So either everybody's going to suffer because they're all going to make some money, or, you know, there's only so many tourists and locals that you can divvy up. We'll have to see what happens. But even A Bronx Tale, frankly, I don't want to overlook that. That's a movie that got poor reviews, but they always said this was sort of a donut hit, a show that, you know, the critics didn't like and New Yorkers didn't like, but the tourists in the suburbs and the outer ring of the city, they're liking it. That's made $900,000 last year. That might be turning into a word of mouth hit. We'll need a few more months to know, but that could become a successful show as well. Cate Blanchett's doing great in the present. This Chekhov play, which got terrible reviews, pretty much deservedly so. You know, so we'll have to see. But yeah, it's going to be quite the logjam.
So you're saying A Bronx Tale is a donut hit. You know, there might be a political leader that falls into that category.
Keep going.
Okay, well, you know, we talk about peak television. I guess what you're saying is we may have reached peak theater.
That's right.
For a hot moment, the coolest trick was to renew a TV series even before a single episode had aired. Not even one. Now the newest way to show confidence is to renew a show for not one, but 2 seasons. This makes sense. Why pretend Empire was on pins and needles for a season 3, much less a season 2 after it debuted and then grew and grew and its audience just kept growing? NBC's This Is Us is another new red-hot drama, and they've just announced that it will be back for at least 2 more seasons. And guess what? So will Showbiz Sandbox. You heard it here first. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's a change, and I think it makes sense. You know, they've looked at the show. You know it's going to be around for 3 years. It's not going to suddenly implode in a minute. It keeps growing, kind of like Empire. And I think it's great news for the networks to have these shows that are not just hitting, but hitting and word spreading to get bigger. That's hasn't happened a lot in history, and it's kind of happening twice in a row now. So that's good. That's a good job.
Wasn't Netflix supposed to be slowing down, by the way? Stop me if I'm wrong, but analysts were hand-wringing about the wall Netflix was hitting in subscribers, both in the U.S. and around the world. Instead, they saw the ever-rising fees they would be paying to studios for access to their movie and TV libraries and figured out it would be a lot smarter to create their own library of shows. That's precisely what Netflix has done to exceptional success, and the results are paying off. The company continues to expand its brand to at least a little local programming for as many countries around the world as they can. They added more than 7 million subscribers worldwide in the fourth quarter alone, beating expectations in the U.S. and internationally. They have a smidge under 50 million subscribers in the U.S. and more than 44 million overseas. And yes, we're about to state the obvious, that overseas number can grow a lot bigger. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. And I think when skinny bundles become a reality in the U.S., and that's about to happen in a New York minute, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
The one extra channel people are going to want to pay for is HBO. I mean, Netflix. I mean, they're going to want Netflix. I really think they are. And HBO, perhaps. Those are the two channels that are going to be right up there in anybody's want list. And I think that's going to create a new explosion. Once they can sign off on networks, they're going to have a little extra money. And those people who haven't bothered yet, they're going to say Netflix.
That's true.
And I think, you know, 150 million worldwide, surely that's possible, right?
That is very true. Yes, I believe so. Now, let's boldly go where no one has gone before and then get sued. That's the story of the fan-funded feature film Prelude to Axanar, which really, really thought they had cleared everything with Paramount before raising more than $1 million to make a professional Star Trek movie with real actors that would be commercially released. Can't see what the problem is there.
Nothing
at all. Paramount said, hold on there, and finally sued. After the fan-funded project lost key early battles, a settlement has been reached with the movie's backers agreeing to substantially change elements of the film so it will satisfy Paramount. No word yet on a release date, or if that's even possible, since the movie is most definitely set in the Star Trek universe. Meanwhile, the new Star Trek TV series Discovery has started filming this week, but its premiere has been delayed again. Big deal or big whoop?
I think you can never tell from a show, from a troubled production history, whether it's going to be good or bad. Look at Casablanca, the classic example, but it ain't good news for Discovery. I mean, this is the third delay. First it was January, then May. Now it's been pushed back again. They do say they're going to start filming this week, so that's a good sign. I figure we'll probably see the new episodes of Will and Grace before we see the new Star Trek series.
Oh, that's right. I guess Will and Grace is coming back to television. It was last seen, I think its last episode was in 2006, and now they're coming back.
Right. NBC said, no, we'll take 10 episodes. We don't need a long run. We don't need a commitment for 3 years. I think they're saying, you know what? We need to behave more like streaming services and cable channels and the BBC. And networks have been doing that for a while. And this is one more example of flexibility. You got a year-round programming need, and Will and Grace, 10 episodes. If you can make the numbers work, why not? So I think with Axanar, the Star Trek movie, I still don't understand why the studio didn't just say, all right, we'll adopt it. You'll have our approval, therefore nobody else can say they can just do it on their own, and profits will go to charity. I think that would have taken care of everything. I'm not sure what they could possibly do to make it not infringe on Star Trek. I mean, what, it'll be a 10-minute short, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's just, and the fact that they're not talking about a release date or what, it sounds like a big mess. They seem to have tried to go through the studio, but, you know, they're trying to not create bad will with the fans, I think, as much as anything.
Roman Polanski was named the president of the French Film César Awards, sparking the expected tsunami of complaints, and rightly so. See, Nate Parker, it isn't just you. The people behind the Césars may have been a little puzzled since they've showered Polanski with nominations and awards in the last few years. Still, people were offended, protests were planned, and Polanski decided to step down. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop since he decided to step down. There's one a difference between thinking somebody should not be extradited to another country and thrown into jail, thinking that a plea deal was made, and another thing between honoring them and having them be the headlight of your ceremony. You know, it's just not the same thing. You can agree that maybe Polanski should not be in jail in the U.S. and not think he should be the president of the César Awards.
That is correct. That is, especially given if you want to understand why Michael says that. Watch the movie Wanted, the Roman Polanski documentary. It's a good film. Now, maybe Roman Polanski could hang out with Saturday Night Live writer Katie Rich. She was suspended from the Red Hot sketch comedy show after tweeting a joke about President Trump's 10-year-old son, Barron. Rich had predicted Barron would become the country's first homeschool shooter, which is actually kind of funny, but really, we should be applauding Rich for her amazing feat of managing to make a tasteless joke about the first children. By the way, minors should be off limits. And at the same time, presidential assassination. She did that all in one fell swoop. Rich apologized and has been suspended for an undetermined amount of time, i.e. she's been fired probably. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. She should have been suspended. She should have felt people go, that's ridiculous and absurd. You know, you got to give the first kids space. They're minors, whether it's Chelsea Clinton or the Obama children or Trump's child. We're not talking about his adult children who are working with him. We're talking about minors, and they should be given their privacy as much as possible. So she was wrong to do it, and they behaved properly. So that's good. But, you know, SNL, we call it red hot. You know what? I mean, maybe the Emmys will name it the best variety show for the first time since 1993 as a sort of slam against Trump. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. And that's going to be in September when Stephen Colbert will be hosting.
That's right. Stephen Colbert named the host of the Emmy Awards. Now, I guess my question is, will it be aired on CBS? I'm almost sure that I know the answer to that question. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, so Stephen Colbert is the host of The Late Show on CBS. So, of course, they needed a host. Guess where they're going to go? Hey, what about our late night talk show host? Done. It just so happens, and I don't know, I think I've mentioned this, this whole Trump thing might be bad for the country, but boy, is it great for Stephen Colbert, because he really has found his voice speaking out against Trump on his show every night.
I haven't been watching. I'll have to check it out.
Okay, now this next story, well, I just knew that, Michael, you would love this, because one thing is certain, you won't be watching Saturday Night Live or the Emmys in 3D. Samsung stopped supporting 3D TV in 2016. Now LG and Sony have confirmed they will stop supporting the format in 2017. Absolutely none of their TVs will be able to display 3D, and thus the absurd idea of 3D TV in the home is dead. Dead, 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 dead. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? We've seen it coming. And we're talking about 3D where you have to put on glasses if they someday figure out how to do it in the home where you don't put on glasses and don't feel like you're, you know, ignoring everybody around you. Maybe that's a new thing that can work. We've certainly seen virtual headsets work in the home. But yeah, we've seen this. The writing was on the wall. It didn't make sense. I never thought there was a market for it, and it turned out there wasn't really, unless you blame not enough content for the reason. But I think it just people didn't want it.
Well, you say virtual headsets, you mean VR headsets. And, you know, I think we have an email from James Gardner. Normally we read them at the end of the show, but it kind of relates to this story. He sent in an article about 3TV being dead. And he He says, well, what does it mean for 3D in the cinema? If there's
no, that's actually a good question. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, he says, if there is no market for 3D after cinema, is it worth the extra cost in production? Is the cinema only perception of benefit worth the effort? At the very least, it leads to an even more reduced reason for 3D. It also brings us to a possibility that 3D is so marginalized that upkeep of the equipment will also become a problem for exhibitors or movie theater owners.
Well, that's a good question. I hadn't thought about it. I certainly think that 3D in the movies didn't depend on people wanting to watch them again in their home, but it certainly was going to be a valuable amount of library that could say, hey, you want to watch Avatar, you want to watch these movies, here they are in 3D. So you can do that in the home. But I hadn't really thought about that. What is that? Is that a backwards backwash effect, Sperling? Do you think that it makes, since there's no market for it in the home, it makes it less important theatrically?
I don't know. However, I do think that is a good celluloid junkie post that I should probably look into, because here's the thing. I wonder if studios were even kind of banking on 3D in the home at all, or whether they were saying, you know what, it's enough to get the upcharge in the cinema itself. That film will always be in 3D. So if audio stereoscopic, television sets come around, we'll have the production.
We'll be ready.
We'll be ready. And we're not counting on breaking even off of 3D in the home. So as long as it, you know, makes some money in the movie theater, we'll be fine. It's certainly for theater owners. It's just one more thing to differentiate their product versus what you can get in the home. Right.
Right. But let's be clear. 3D in cinema has also gone way down.
It's between 30% and 40%. Correct.
No.
Of the box office.
30% for an opening weekend
of
for
the box office.
Fewer and fewer movies that get shown in 3D.
Correct.
Right. So it's far less popular. People were excited by it for a few years. They've turned their backs on it. They don't want 3D for most movies. Woody Allen was going to be in 3D. That is dead. Most movies are not in 3D. Certain big summer blockbusters and the next Avatar are in 3D, but it's far less prominent than it was even 5 years ago. And people don't want it really.
Yeah,
right for a handful of movies, okay. They don't want to pay extra for it, but they'll grudgingly do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jeffrey Katzenberg has even said, yeah, maybe saying The Queen in 3D would have worked. That might have, or The Departed, that may have been overstating it.
But you think?
But certainly thank you, James, for writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com with your comments. That actually, as you can see, does help us out here. But that moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, I guess, we're affected because we're all listening to Ed Sheeran.
That's right. He's the first artist in history to debut two songs in the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. I don't think anyone's done it even on any previous charts that constituted the standard for music. One of them was number 6, so he damn near came into at number 5. So he almost had two in the top 5. So what a bummer. One was Shape of You, which debuted at number 1, and Castle on the Hill debuted at number 6. So that's an amazing accomplishment for that guy, who really sprang up very naturally. You know, he feels like an artist people really discovered naturally, became a big hit naturally, toured to solidify that bond with his audience. Now here he comes back taking his time, and his new album is going to be coming out. And obviously there's a lot of pent up demand for that.
I've seen a couple of concerts of his on film, not on.
You went to see him in concert, really?
No,
you've seen
no.
A couple of them on film?
Yeah, just, flipping through the channels. It's like, oh, look, it's Ed Sheeran. And, you'd watch the rest of the show. And boy, he puts on a good show. He's like a really good musician.
I haven't seen him in concert. I don't particularly like his album, but it's, I don't have any animus against it. Yeah, so there's a lot of attention on the Hot 100. And over on the album charts, there's a lot going on, too. But it's not because of sales. The group The Weeknd is on number 1 for the 3rd week in a row, and they face some tough challenges. 2 weeks ago it was the Moana soundtrack, last week it was the La La Land soundtrack, and this week it's the alternative band The XX. They debuted at number 2. It's their highest debuting week ever. It's only like their second album, but you can forget about
excuse
album
me,
sales.
Their third album. Thank you very much.
Is it their third? Oh, I beg your pardon. You can forget about album sales. That's not what we're talking about, physical or digital. That's not important. The Weeknd's album Starboy is at number 1. It sold about 13,000 copies in physical and digital. And then another 10,000 track equivalent album sales, which I assume means about, certain songs sold 10,000 tracks. And the rest of its power came through 57 million streams. I think XX had slightly more album sales, but again, we're talking about the low 10,000s. This is all about streaming now. It might as well be called the, you know, instead of the top hot 200, it should be called the top 200 streaming chart. I mean, it's not about sales at all anymore.
Yeah, I mean, even in Zootopia at one point, and I keep going back to Zootopia, but the fox in that film opens a glove compartment box and finds CDs in the glove compartment. He's like, CDs? Who uses CDs anymore?
Yeah, no, it's a sea change. It really is. It's just more and more. There are no album sales. I think Adam Clayton of U2 was talking about their touring behind the Joshua Tree, which of course sold a ton of copies on CD, and saying, hey, you know, you just don't sell albums anymore. It's just not the game. You know, it's just not what it's about. And I think the chart should even more, I think it should just be the streaming chart, you know, have a separate chart. I mean, I just don't think that's where the action is. It's not important, I guess. If you're number one and you sold 13,000 copies, it's not a sales chart. You know, and I do think just converting the streams to sales is stupid the way they do it. You know, if you play one song a billion times, they constitute that as like a certain number of album sales. It's ridiculous. It's just the one song. Unless they play like 60% of the album, it shouldn't constitute somebody listening to that album. It's just a hot song.
I agree with that.
I think their formula's not there. I think they need to rework it and just say, you know what, it's a streaming chart.
Well, and quite honestly, the number of albums that I listen to incomplete, because, you know, I've heard, oh, you know, the album's okay, or there's a couple good songs on it. I listen to the whole album. I might do it once. I never in a million years would have purchased that album. Now, that is a different consumer choice, okay? So you're really comparing different consumer habits here. It just doesn't really equal.
Yeah, and you know what? Why buy an album where you can buy publishing rights?
Yeah, publishing really is where it's at. I mean, let's face it. You just ask Dolly Parton. I mean, she's made a mint from her publishing rights alone, even if she never sang one of her songs. But this week, we're talking about Paul McCartney suing Sony over the rights to Beatles music.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, haven't we? The fallout from the 1976 Copyright Act by Congress. In a bad move, Congress was extending the length of copyright yet again back in the 70s. It's gone on so long, it's called the Mickey Mouse Law, because Mickey Mouse will apparently never go into the public domain if Disney and its lobbyists have anything to say about it. So they said, all right, you know, a lot of people signed away their rights when they had no power over their contracts. And so they said back in 1976, they said, okay, all right, 35 years from now, artists can move to regain their publishing and other copyrights from the current owners. Because 35 years is so far away. Nobody thought like, that's never going to get here. It's never going to happen. Now it's come. And everyone from Bob Dylan to Tom Petty to Prince have used just the threat of filing to reclaim their publishing to negotiate better deals. Yoko Ono did the same for John Lennon's estate, but Paul McCartney, who's felt burned ever since Michael Jackson stole the Beatles catalog from him by outbidding for what seems the pittance of $40 million, he's been furious about not owning his own songs, and he has been filing legal notices apparently for quite a few years now, alerting to everyone, I'm going to reclaim my publishing, and he thinks he'll be able to do that starting in 2018. Now, what has happened this week? What's going on? He filed a move in court in New York to get a declaratory judgment that he will indeed soon be regaining copyright ownership of his stake in the Beatles songs. And he did it in New York because Duran Duran lost a court battle in the UK, and he'd rather not have have stuff going on in that country. He'd rather establish his claim in New York first.
Right. I mean, it's the reason that you see all, you know, patent infringement lawsuits take place for some reason in Austin, Texas. I mean, it's not Silicon Valley. It's not New York. It's not where, you know, the technology is made. But that court happens to be very favorable for patent infringement lawsuits.
Well, you want to find a favorable house for your hearing. And Duran Duran lost in the UK because a judge ruled that U.S. law took a backseat to English law, which includes a provision in their contract that said they agreed not to transfer their interest in copyrights. And apparently they said that includes not transferring it to yourself.
Right.
They're like, well, can't we give it to us? And they're like, no.
No. So that's transfer, that's by the way. That's called transfer.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul McCartney, I don't know what his contract is, if that's a clause he has to worry about, but he's trying to declare this in New York. It's not the first time he's done this, but it is going to be a battle royale because it's the Beatles catalog.
Well, right. And I guess at some point you kind of have to ask yourself, look, if 35 years from 1976 is the rule, like how many ways can you get around that? And at what point is it not really a rule at all?
If nobody can reclaim their rights. Well, they are, though. They are getting better terms or deals. So it is having an effect already.
Yeah, unlike, say, well, maybe Neil Young is a bad example of this, but not everybody would want to reclaim their rights because then they'd have to administrate their rights, meaning they'd have to find a publisher, they'd have to kind of audit the publisher, you know, it's not
easy.
But
they can renegotiate their deal and get better terms.
Right, from their current publisher and their current record label. That said, a group like the Beatles, however, as you can see, there is a whole publishing company around just that music, around administrating just and licensing just that music.
Yeah, or just Prince. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Neil Young, if he doesn't own his publishing, sure as hell wants to.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, I hope all these people pay attention to their publishing rights and pay attention to their manager.
Well, Alanis
Morissette, her former manager, admitted to bilking her of millions. This just goes on all the time. If you are a multimillionaire and for some reason you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, here's a clue. Get somebody independent of your manager to audit your stuff every single year. You're worth millions. You can afford it. And checking up on who's watching the Watchmen.
Yeah. So you're asking, you're saying that if you're a millionaire entertainer, look, you know, don't just trust your manager. Get an independent audit.
Right. And, you know, it has to rotate out. It has to be somebody that doesn't do business with them. It's not just for celebrities and entertainers. It's for churches. My local parish, pushing them. You want an outside auditor to step in because the church does business. Your local parish does business with this, you know, tax person. And they're the ones who work with them all the time. So therefore, they have this, you know, understanding. And you got to have someone else come in and oversee it every once in a while to make sure everything is on the up and up. Because once you have a relationship with them, if they're the ones paying your bills, sometimes you look the other way. Sometimes, you know, you've got to have an independent authority come in every year or 2 years or 3 years at the most and check up on who's people that doing business for you. So, you know, it's worth the money. Good God. Neil Diamond, Alanis Morissette, Leonard Cohen, the stories of smart, you know, artists who
Billy
get ripped
Joel,
off.
Billy Joel.
They're endless.
Did you mention Leonard Cohen?
Yeah.
Okay.
It just goes on and on. It's got to be it's upsetting.
Well, certainly we're going to have somebody do an independent audit of our books here at Showbiz Sandbox. It's going to be really easy.
The money.
It's going to be incredibly inexpensive. We will pay them exactly what we earn, in fact. because we don't earn anything. See, that's the joke there. It's you know, we get paid by your love. So please do subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away or aggregate podcasts. We can usually be found. You can rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you subscribe and rate and review the show. So please do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as all of those ways to subscribe to us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you can find us there. You can like our page there. Again, all that information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Mudbound is OscarBound.com.
Ooh.
I like to get on my Oscar campaigns early.
Yeah, that's actually not only before, it is before the movie has been released, technically.
Not technically, it is.
That's true. Now, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or even MichaelGiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.